Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in today's show, the push to ban rodeos in the city of Los Angeles. What effect could that have down the road for animal agriculture? And the governor gives his State of the State address. We take a look at some of his key points. We also have today's news, but we start today with food safety inspections. No matter how prepared or compliant you are, it can still be nerve-wracking to get a notice that you're going to be inspected. So to talk about preparing for inspections, I'm on the phone with Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety for the Western Ag Processors Association.
So can you start off with telling me a little bit about the inspections and what people should know?
Absolutely. So produce safety rule inspections began. It'll be about 2 years now. And they are for farms that are considered large farms. So anybody who has over $500,000 in average annual sales, they are the ones that are eligible for inspection. Later on this year, the small farms will also be included into that. So that would be anybody above $250,000 in average annual sales. So what the inspections include, they're going over the key items where contaminations could possibly happen to the product. So those items are going to be your personnel. So personnel qualifications and training is going to be one of the things that they're going to be looking at. So they're going to be making sure that you as a grower or the operator of the huller are trained in the produce safety rule. So you have to have that grower training certificate. They want to make sure that your employees are trained as well, and what topics those are covered. Other items that they'll be looking at is sanitation of your equipment, tools, buildings. They'll want to see logs for all of that, making sure that you're cleaning and sanitizing appropriately for your facility. Now, when they go out and they determine what you're doing for sanitation, it's not up to them to necessarily say, this works or this doesn't work. You're the one that needs to determine what the frequency and method of cleaning should be. They're just there to make sure that it's being done. So that's the reason why they'll look at those logs that you should have to make sure that you're doing that sanitation of cleaning of the equipment, tools, and buildings, which include obviously your bathrooms. That's one big area, and making sure that it's stocked up. Another area that they'll look at is the growing, harvesting, and packing, your practices that you have on the farm. Specifically for tree nuts, they'll want to make sure that before you harvest out in the field, that you're doing your walk around or your drive through to make sure that there's no possible contamination of the product. So for example, things that can happen is there could be a dead animal or feces on the ground next to tree nuts that you're going to be harvesting up. So you want to make sure that you're doing that drive around and make sure that if there is that type of contamination that you're addressing it before so that it does not get harvested. So those are the type of things that they're going to be looking for, those practices. And then the same thing would be hold true for the huller. If you have any type of contamination, if some type of dead animal does come into the huller, or there's something that happens, some type of contamination, that you're addressing that contamination, removing the product that shouldn't be processed anymore or hauled anymore, and then make sure you're doing your cleaning and sanitizing. Beyond that, there's also, they want to make sure that you're observing the area for domestic and wild animals. Nowhere in the rule does it say that you should not have any wild animals. Obviously, that's going to be impossible. We're talking about out of nature. But what it does do is it wants you to do that, again, that practice of making sure you're doing your inspection before you harvest to see if there's any instances where there's feces, where there could be that contamination to the product. So all of this is to prevent any contamination to the commodity that's going to be harvested or processed. Now, another is worker health and hygiene, making sure that you're training your employees on what they shouldn't do. So, for example, if you're sick, you want to make sure that your employees are trained on what the signs and symptoms are of sicknesses, and making sure that they're reporting that to the supervisor and that they understand what that should be. And those practices should also apply to any visitor that you have. So if I'm on a property for one of our members, I'm technically a visitor, so they should be letting me know what those policies are, that I shouldn't be touching the product, that I should wash my hands after using the bathroom, making sure, again, that the commodity is safe of contamination. So those are the primary areas that they're going to be looking at. The one of the areas that which is watering is a big one, isn't actually required at this time. So they won't start, or you don't have to start building your water quality profile until 2022. So next year, folks will have to start testing their water to build that water quality profile. And they'll have 2 to 4 years to build that. And then once that is in place, then when the inspections happen for that, they will start looking at those testing requirements. But for the most part, that is what's entailed in these inspections. The inspections vary in terms of length. They can be anywhere from 2 to 4 hours or even longer, depending on the amount of commodity you have. If you have multiple commodities, obviously that'll take a little more time. From the experiences that I've had on these produce safety rule inspections is that if you're prepared with the documentation that is required, then these seem to go very fast. One of my more recent inspections that I participated in was less than 2 hours, and it was a walnut huller, and they had orchards as well, and it was less than 2 hours because they had all their ducks in a row, they had all their paperwork there, ready to go. So making sure you have your documentation, and the documentation is going to be on those key items that I just explained earlier.
And you have time to get all of that together, too, because these are not surprise inspections. They tell you that they're going to come out, right?
That is correct. So you typically, they provide you a week notice. They'll call you a week before, let you know that you're about to be inspected. And they actually do try to work with you because they understand that when you're in season, things could be a little hectic. So they really do try to work with you. And usually you'll have a 1 to 2 week advance notice of when they're coming out. So you do have time to prepare, making sure that you have all those training records or the documentation that you're going to need, and easier to compile it in one binder if you can, so that it's there and easy going when the inspector gets there.
And I know, you know, most ag companies, you know, they follow the rules, they do what they need to do to keep the food safe. But even so, having a state inspection, having an inspector come out can be intimidating. What would you recommend that, you know, a business owner does when they find out they're going to be inspected?
Absolutely. So it's always nerve-wracking when you have an inspection. That's completely understandable. My recommendation, especially for those that are in our part of our membership, this is included in our membership, which is the food safety plan that we created that meets the requirements and has all the required documentation in there. So you could definitely reach out to us at our WAPA office, and we can get that those forms over to you, that food safety plan over to you, so that you can have that ready to go by the time the inspector gets there. Otherwise, there are some tools online. The Produce Safety Alliance does have some, they do have some templates that you can use on their website. You just want to make sure that you're making the edits to it so that it accommodates what your practices are on your farm. So you don't want to show something that's not appropriate for you. Another thing that they will ask for is like your sanitation procedures, and that's also something that we create into our plan. So they're called SSOPs, and we have those already set for the different treated commodities as well. So the best thing you can do is prepare. Like I said, there's free materials online that you can use, or if you're a member of ours, we'd be happy and glad to help you.
Once you've been inspected, can you expect to be inspected again next year, or is there a rotation for this?
So you definitely probably will not be inspected the following year. It will probably be another couple of years, unless that there's an outbreak or there's a reason to be going out to your facility, there's a contamination, and that would obviously be reason for them to come out whenever the contamination happens. There are 30,000 farms in California, and they right now are just building up their inspectors. So they have over 10 right now. So that, you know, it's going to take time to build that up, especially with everything going on with COVID. Things aren't as fast as they probably would have been had COVID not been in place. So no, you probably should not have an inspection every year. That wouldn't be likely, but it's always good to be prepared because you never know if an outbreak can happen, or there may be an instance, some sort of instance come up where food safety can be an issue. So you just want to make sure that you're prepared. And like you mentioned, most farmers are already doing a lot of this stuff. And what I found from my experience is it's the documentation portion that most people lack. So making sure that the documentation is being kept up is going to be your best way to make sure that when an inspection happens, you're ready to go.
All right. Now, is there anything else that we should have talked about, or anything I should have asked?
So the other thing that I would recommend is for folks who can do this is do an on-farm readiness review. So CDFA, who's the entity that's doing inspections, also offers these on-farm readiness reviews, which are kind of like a cheat sheet, if you will, for a test. They come out and do these voluntary inspections before you are doing any type of produce safety rule official inspection, and they determine whether or not you are ready for an actual inspection. That's exactly what's in the name, right? Readiness review. So they go through the, it's more of a conversation piece that they have with you, and they go over all the line items that I went over with you today, and they just have a conversation with you about it, and they tell you, you know, this is where you could be better, you know, you can do this, try this. And so they give you those recommendations, and it really just allows you to make sure that you are prepared when the time comes for an actual inspection. Now, those on-farm readiness reviews are only allowed for folks right now who are have less than $500,000 in average annual sales, because otherwise you would be already in the inspection period where you should be in compliance with the rule. So that's another opportunity to just make sure that you are prepared, so when inspections begin, you can pass with flying colors.
All right. Unless you can think of anything else that we should get in there.
You know what? I actually want, so one other thing, because I've done several inspections, just some of the key things that folks are missing during inspections. One is documentation, as I mentioned earlier. The second is making sure that farms have a physical address on their documentation. So it doesn't suffice to say this is, Rodriguez Ranch Farm number one, Rodriguez Ranch Farm number two. You have to have a physical address. And from my conversations with the CDFA inspectors, about 90% of inspections, that'll be one of the findings, is that they're lacking an actual physical location address. So make sure you have that. It's an easy fix. If you already have a bunch of documents that don't have it, you know, create some labels and stick it on there, and you'll be set. So that those are two of the things that are the findings that are more frequent in inspections. So that would be an advice for me.
Thank you again to Priscilla Rodriguez. When we come back, we have today's news brief. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Welcome back. Here's your news brief for today. Citrus growers and industry members in Ventura County are invited to attend a virtual meeting on Monday, March 15th, to help prepare for regulatory requirements that may be expected in the event that Huanglongbing is detected nearby. Representatives from the California Department of Food and Agriculture and the County Commissioner's Office will be presenting on HLB regulatory protocols and mitigations for moving bulk citrus when there is an HLB quarantine. This is also an opportunity to ask questions of the regulators. You can find registration information at citrusinsider.org. Avocados continue finding their way onto the tables of an increasing number of U.S. households as the category continues to develop and cement its place as one of the largest categories in fresh produce. A recent study by the Hass Avocado Board found that purchases of avocados have increased substantially over the four-year period of 2016 to 2019. The study indicates that the growth is coming from a growing segment of, quote, super avocado shoppers. Meanwhile, the California Avocado Commission has updated the forecast for its fiscal year 2020 to 2021 to 292 million pounds. That is an 8% reduction from its preseason crop estimate and in the range of an average size crop. USDA researchers are studying how various non-lethal tools and strategies within an integrated approach can protect livestock from predator attack. Rod Bain has the details.
Integrated livestock protection is what it sounds like.
An integrated system basically uses the best tools at the best time to use those tools.
Regarding the protection of livestock from predators, according to Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service Wildlife Services, Julie Young. Her colleague, Elizabeth Miller, adds several of these tools and strategies are used in combination and are non-lethal.
Things like range riding or flattery or electrified fencing or permanent fencing, those are some of the most popular.
Young says ongoing study by Wildlife Services looks at the efficiency and cost-effectiveness of these tools, both individually and working together as part of an integrated system.
We have several sources of data that we'll be looking at, including man hours and cost. And we want to make sure that the amount of livestock saved, the amount of conflict reduced, really matters and is worth the time and money spent on these tools.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA is in need of three nominees for the Christmas Tree Promotion Board. Seats open for nominees are two Western Region producers and one Eastern Region producer. USDA will appoint members to serve three-year terms that begin on January 1st of 2022. The board conducts an industry election to choose nominees to be considered for appointments by USDA. The Christmas Tree Promotion Board is industry-funded and supports the national research, marketing, and promotion of Christmas trees. The board is composed of 12 members, including 11 producers from the western, central, and eastern regions of the United States, and one importer member. More information about the board is available on the Agricultural Marketing Service Christmas Tree Promotion Board webpage and on the board's website, ChristmasTreePromotionBoard.org. For trade data purposes, USDA is changing the definition of agricultural products to include more products. Gary Crawford has more from the USDA.
The USDA in its ag trade data is changing its definition of agricultural products, in essence adding some items to its calculations for ag exports, imports, and trade balance.
Adopting this definition puts us in line with more of the international community as far as our trade data.
USDA economist Bart Kenner says now USDA's numbers will match those of the World Trade Organization and the U.S. Trade Representative's office as well. As to what's being added to USDA's ag product list,
distilled spirits, liquors, ethanol, which was not included before, manufactured tobacco.
And so this will raise the export-import ag trade numbers being reported. For example, looking at our numbers for this fiscal year, October through January, the addition of these products
results in a 3% higher number for agricultural exports and an 8% higher number for agricultural imports.
But Kenner says long term overall,
not too big of a change.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The latest numbers show Chinese purchases of U.S. agricultural products are continuing to be above last year's levels. Which commodities are set to be the biggest beneficiaries of China's growing demand for ag imports? Stephanie Ho looks into it.
The importance of China as a market for U.S. agricultural exports was underscored by Biden administration Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
I think we've seen in some commodities record purchases by the Chinese, and most recently very large purchases of commodities. And I think that's one of the reasons why if you look at commodity prices today versus where they were a year ago, you're going to see across the board increases, which obviously is good news. And for many farmers, ranchers, and producers, it's the best news they've had in some time.
A panel at USDA's annual Agricultural Outlook Forum examined the issue.
The USDA came out with its latest quarterly forecast for 2021 agricultural exports. And if you hadn't seen the numbers, they are quite fascinating, with exports expected to reach more than $31 billion for China.
That was Daniel Whitley, Acting Foreign Agricultural Service Administrator. USDA Trade Counselor Jason Halfmeister pointed to U.S. agriculture's share of total Chinese imports before and after the trade war, which dates back to 2017.
About 20-25% of China's imports came from the United States of ag products. Trade war cut that down around 10. Last year, we bounced back to 14.
In his presentation, he showed a chart that forecasts steep increases in Chinese purchases of U.S. soybeans.
This is a most stunning graph you'll see all day. This is Chinese imports of soybeans. You know, from 2010 to 2030, they've gone from 45 million metric tons to maybe 140.
Another bright spot in ag trade has been U.S. corn sales to China, which started off slowly in the beginning of 2020.
But contracts were signed and boats loaded at the end of the year and turned into a record year for us on corn to China.
Other beneficiaries include sorghum, wheat, and cotton. For ag producers, another important development is China's unexpectedly strong demand for protein.
Back in 2010, we projected that China would be importing roughly 1 million tons of meat by now. And then 5 years later, we ratcheted that up to about 2 to 3 million tons by now. But they actually imported over 9 million tons last year.
Fred Gale is with USDA's Economic Research Service.
Our projections show that China will continue to grow those meat imports up to more than 10 million tons by the end of the projection period.
He says ERS sees China as the world's top importer of beef and pork and a significant importer of poultry by 2030. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The ruling in a California lawsuit over origin and ownership of a specific type of plant goes to the defendant. Monrovia Nursery Company was the defendant in a patent infringement lawsuit over the origin and ownership of a double-flowering mandevilla vine. The lawsuit, brought on by James M. Green and others in the Green family, claimed that Monrovia owed them royalties from plants originating from one of the Green's mandevilla plant cultivars. However, the court ruled there was not evidence that the cultivar in Monrovia's plants was from the Greens. That's your news brief for today. Coming up next, Los Angeles is looking at banning rodeos and similar events. What effect could that have? We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. National agriculture groups are paying attention to a movement in Los Angeles to ban rodeos and similar events. A member of the Los Angeles City Council asked the city attorney to write an ordinance effectively banning rodeo and other animal exhibitions. The motion requesting the ordinance was signed by Los Angeles City Council member Bob Blumenfield and seconded by Mitchell Farrell. Here's some of the wording from that request. The City of Los Angeles has a history of acting in the best interest of animal welfare. The city took a leadership role in banning the use of bull hooks in the handling of elephants at traveling circuses or exhibitions, and the sale of fur products. Action to address inhumane treatment of animals at rodeos and rodeo-like events is long overdue. Numerous American cities have rodeo prohibitions or restrictions in place, including Pasadena, Irvine, and Napa County in California. That motion also states, quote, there are a number of rodeo events in the county and city of Los Angeles that utilize inhumane methods or instruments during their events. It is time for our city to act in the interest of animal welfare on this issue, as it has in the past for other issues. In this request, there is no information from the experts on these events or from the people who are actually in charge of the animals. A group called Western Justice has started a petition on change.org to encourage the LA City Council not to put the ordinance into place. And the national organization Protect the Harvest has taken note and is encouraging its supporters to sign that petition. To talk more about it, Protect the Harvest Board President Dale Ludwig joins me now on the phone.
Would you please tell me just a little bit about why this issue is important, first off, to Protect the Harvest?
Protect the Harvest was started about 10 years ago. With the effort of preventing animal rights groups from trying to eliminate animals from humans being able to enjoy them, control them, harvest them for food. And if you look at what most of the animal rights groups are, that's exactly what they intend to do, is actually eliminate animals as being used by humans for anything, including pets. So if you're like a pet owner, like most of us are, and you want to make sure that animals are treated humanely, we're your guys, because we totally agree with humane treatment. But we don't think that animals have rights like people do. They don't have souls. And so we're animal humanity, not animal rights. As far as the whole thing in Los Angeles, it's kind of one of those things where oftentimes these groups start somewhere where there isn't a whole lot of interest or people that would be against eliminating rodeos. How many rodeos are there in LA? But it's a start. It's like the camel's nose under the tent that then leads, they go on to, if you look at LA is one thing, but if you look at LA County, that is a much bigger area. And so it's just kind of a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. This is, like you said, it's a place to start because it's an easy place to start,
right,
being in the city. But then there are many areas in California. I mean, Clovis, in where I'm from, has a huge rodeo, and the community loves its rodeo. What is the risk, and what have we seen in the past with other things similar to this, where the animal rights groups start in the city with something small, and then it grows? Can we see impacts from this in other areas?
Well, you know, one of the big examples is farrowing crates and gestation crates that they outlawed in Florida. Florida wasn't a heavy lift because there aren't any hogs in Florida, right? But then once they get a foothold somewhere, it's easier to move, to take that and use that as an example, like a leading state like Florida has decided to eliminate gestation crates, and it just kind of moves across the country then.
Right. And California, of course, has seen a couple of those too, with our eggs and things.
Yeah. And then, it's what we thought was something that was interstate commerce issue. They've been able to uphold the requirements on egg production in other states kind of across the entire country that end up being sold in California. And once you make that change, then it's like it becomes somewhat difficult to raise a certain set of eggs for California and another set of eggs for everywhere else. So in many cases, you have a gravitation to what the rules and regulations are in California, which might not seem all that like that big a deal, other than it has dramatically increased the price of eggs. And if you happen to be like a single parent mother that is like on a limited income, eggs are one of the things that you tend to use a lot of. So it can make a big difference.
And then, we like to say it starts in California, but it spreads. And that's why the national organizations like Protect the Harvest keep a close eye.
Exactly.
One of the things that I read in an article that Protect the Harvest put out, a statement that was made, rodeo is misunderstood, so it is an easy target. And in the wording of the ordinance, the motion for the ordinance, it mentions different tools that are used in rodeos, and it sounds to me like scare language. Is this a tactic that you've seen used in other places as well?
Yeah, well, in what the goal is here is to take a look at some of the equipment. They use a strap that goes under a bull's like midsection or stomach in its flank, which is part of what causes them to buck. And so if you were to outlaw those, which is one of their tactics, then you don't get rid of rodeos, but you get rid of all the things that you need in order to actually perform a rodeo, if you know what I mean. So it's kind of their approach where it's a really heavy lift to convince people that we shouldn't have rodeos anymore, but maybe these straps that go under their midsection in their flank, maybe that thankful. So if we outlawed that, it wouldn't be so bad. But it kind of eliminates your ability to actually have bull riding.
Right, exactly. But like you said, it's easier to pass it if you make it sound like we're just passing these certain devices or methods
that are painful to the animal, which these these bucking bulls get treated as good as your dog for the most part.
Yeah, and you know, that's something that I was curious about also, because rodeo animals are expensive. And when I have seen them, I've been able to go backstage for professional bull riding and have seen how, you know, behind the scenes, how things go. But I've never seen an animal mistreated. Of course, some people believe that the bull riding in itself or the bronco is mistreating it. But we're talking about very expensive animals, a huge part of the show. So how are they treated then?
Well, you know, bulls are an interesting example to use, because they can also be pretty mean. So it's a little harder to call them pets, but they are treated extremely well. As you said, they're worth a lot of money. They're bred for the purpose of actually being an aggressive bull that gives a good ride, that causes somebody to not be able to ride, right? And so they're extremely well taken care of as far as feed is concerned, as far as shelter and all those types of things. So, you know, you have to, if you're against rodeoing, you have to approach it in a different manner. And that's kind of why I was using this belly strap thing as an example.
On the big picture, again, like you said, it seems to be a case of these groups starting small and hoping that this movement will continue to grow. And that's why it's important to keep an eye out.
Yes, absolutely. And also, it's important to understand what their ultimate goal is. And that is, you know, not to have ownership of animals, not to use them for food. And, so if you're even a pet owner, as I used the example before, you should like be informed on what these people are trying to do. And interestingly enough, in many cases, you know, they do these like late night PSAs, or maybe they're even paying for the commercials, but asking for donations like $19.99 a month. And they show some animal that's been mistreated. And there's a lot of us that like look at that animal and certainly feel sorry for it and believe that whoever is treating it that way, if it's not a prop, that it's wrong, right? So we send them money, but the problem is, as an example for HSUS, they would have dozens and dozens of attorneys on staff and a whole lot of people who work for them, and $150 to $180 million budget, whatever the number is this year. But it's just an incredible amount of money. And then groups like HSUS are just trying to make sure that they don't make as much progress. And we have to try to do that, because we don't have as much money, by influencing the influencers. And so that would be the city council that we would try to influence in Los Angeles.
All right. And so for people who are listening, they can get more information about this on the protecttheharvest.com website. And there's a pretty good write-up there, including some information on how they can take some action as well. Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, it's just important for all of us to stay informed and understand what people's real motivations are. But rodeoing is like something I've never done a lot of. I've enjoyed watching it. And I think the next generation should be able to enjoy that too. And if we're not extremely careful in what we allow people to do, that won't be the case.
Thank you again to Protect the Harvest Board President Dale Ludwig. When we come back, we hear from Governor Newsom's State of the State address. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
Welcome back. Governor Gavin Newsom held his State of the State address last night from an empty Dodgers stadium. Agriculture-related topics had few mentions during his speech, but there were some, ranging from the pandemic to climate change. He started his speech with the pandemic. He talked about the priorities for vaccines, including farm workers.
See, we prioritize those who are at the greatest risk and with the greatest exposure to the virus. We don't just talk about vaccine equity. We've designed our entire system around it, setting aside 40% of vaccines to the most impacted communities. You know, vaccine equity is not just the right thing to do, it's also the fastest way through this pandemic. Grocery workers prioritize, school staff prioritize, farm workers put to the front of the line. Like 85-year-old Maria. I met her in Fresno. She's from Reedley, California. She came to this country from Mexico decades and decades ago to find a job in our fields. You know, Maria said she was unsure, she was uncertain about getting vaccinated. But after she received her shots, she's now educating other farm workers about the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine, helping them overcome similar anxieties. You know, that's the beauty of California. Leadership like Maria's, it isn't ordained, it's earned. We've built a vaccination system where the only constraint now is simply manufactured supply. And thanks to the Biden administration, those doses are on their way. You know, I've had the privilege over the course of the last many, many weeks to travel all across the state. I've had the chance to see firsthand the strength of communities banding together in Coachella, in Arvin, in Camarillo, in Stockton, stepping up to vaccinate the most vulnerable and the too often overlooked. Every Californian will have access to convenient shots, including those that are homebound and those who don't have transportation or don't have the internet. And now, with greater supply, we're starting to realize the old challenge is going to emerge. And that's the challenge as old as the vaccine themselves. And that's hesitancy about whether to get it in the first place. Just ask Maria. And to address those concerns, we've invested in a large network of trusted community partners, and they're helping us spread the word in many languages and across many different cultures. Vaccines are safe. Vaccines are effective. Vaccines will save your life, allowing you to visit your parents again, go to your daughter's basketball game, show up for shift work without fearing an infection.
And on the general topic of the state's vaccine rollout, he had this.
And we were the first to launch these mass vaccination sites in partnership with FEMA, now a model for other states all across the country. Today we have the most robust vaccination program in the country. Think about this. California now ranks 6th in the world for vaccination distribution, ahead of countries, not states, ahead of countries like Russia, Germany, Israel, and France. You know, I know our progress hasn't always felt fast enough. And look, we've made mistakes. I have made mistakes, but we own them. We learn from them, and we never stop trying. After all, that's the California spirit. We're bent, but not broken, bloodied, but unbowed, resolved to make brighter days ahead and not to let the pain of last year to deter us from the hopefulness of tomorrow. Look, the state of our state, it remains determined. I remain determined. And I just want you to know, we're not going to change course just because of a few naysayers and doomsdayers. So to the California critics out there who are promoting partisan political power grabs with outdated prejudices and rejecting everything that makes California truly great, we say this. We will not be distracted from getting shots in arms and our economy booming again. This is a fight for California's future.
He also talked about reopening the state and financial help for residents, specifically farm workers and small businesses.
You are the ones we fight for because your future and our brighter future depends on it. We continue to work every single day to safely reopen our economy, guided by equity principles, accounting for vaccines and moving as fast as we can, though always mindful that we can't let down our guard, particularly with so many of these new variants. You know, as of today, 24 of our 58 counties are out of the most restrictive tier, and many more are poised to move next week. And as we safely reopen, we're also mindful that we need to do more to provide financial relief. You know, just a few weeks ago, we took action, working with legislative leaders for immediate stimulus to millions and millions of Californians. We just directed $7.6 billion back to hardworking Californians and small businesses hit hardest by COVID. We didn't wait for Washington, we acted with urgency. And that included the Golden State stimulus, which will put $600 directly in the pockets of millions of families, no matter, by the way, what their immigration status is. It included supporting our essential workers with new child care subsidies, more funding for food banks and diapers, as well as financial assistance to farm workers. You know, we'll keep the dream alive, but not only for our families, but for all those small businesses who fought so hard to survive over the past year. You know, it's that special mix of audacity, human capital, and creativity found only in California. That means there's literally no better place to do business. California is where garages are the launch pads for world-changing industries. And anyone with the telltale tenacity of a small business owner can create their own California dream, but only if we nurture them. And that's why we're providing the largest small business grant program in the nation, $2.6 billion, up to $25,000 for small businesses and nonprofits impacted by the pandemic. And behind these grants, there are countless stories of entrepreneurs and the dreams they've pursued with every ounce of energy that they have. Like Francisco in Fresno, who received $5,000 to reopen his pastry business after being closed for nearly 6 months. And Katara, right here in LA, whose dessert cafe used a $15,000 grant to make payroll. And 40,000 other businesses and counting, barber shops and auto repair shops and clothing shops throughout our state. 3/4, by the way, of these grants have gone to minority, women, and veteran-owned businesses, and those serving in rural as well as low-income communities. We're not just talking about equity. We're building it into the very fabric of all of our programs.
Governor Newsom talked about the state's wildfire problems and forest management, as well as climate change and his push for zero-emission vehicles.
Let's call it what it is, climate change. Just as we approach COVID, we are guided by science. Just consider last summer. Last summer's heat dome over the entire west coast of the United States, which led to world record-breaking temperatures here at home. And in just one 24-hour period last August, 12,000 lightning strikes sparked 560 wildfires, requiring heroic efforts by our firefighters and National Guard, who landed helicopters into flames to save fellow Californians. This year, we're budgeting more than $1 billion for fire prevention, including fuel breaks, forest health, and home hardening. We forged an historic partnership with the U.S. Forest Service to radically ramp up forest management efforts, reducing barriers on hundreds of fuel reduction projects and prescribed burns, adding 30 new fire crews and pre-positioning assets, new C-130s, new Black Hawk helicopters, and new radar technology. But historic wildfires, they're the symptom. Greenhouse gases, they're the cause. And to address them, we must confront the source of more than half of the emissions in our state, and that's transportation. And I was proud to sign groundbreaking executive order just last year requiring that all new cars and passenger trucks sold in California be zero emissions by 2035. And the car companies led by Ford, GM, Volvo, and others seized the opportunity to innovate, create jobs, and dominate the industry of the future, proving yet again that protecting our planet, protecting it, and growing our economy, they're not conflicting goals. They're one in the same. Look, there's no doubt that California is the pace setter of environmental policy.
He touched on needed improvements to the state's infrastructure.
Just think about this. This year, we're going to invest over $10 billion in the nuts and bolts of California. Infrastructure like roads and rail and bridges and public transit. The biggest infrastructure package, by the way, since the Great Recession over a decade ago. building towards universal broadband, connecting all Californians equitably and affordably, and investing in our most important asset, our children. You know, we propose in this year's budget to invest a record amount in K-14 education this year.
The governor also talked about several other general population issues, such as reopening schools and pay equity. That is our show for today. If you know of a person or a topic we should feature, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.